This is the Publix Radio. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez. Earlier this week, when Socket City leaders followed the actions of many communities across the country, they voted to fine people who camp out on city property. One unhoused advocacy group says the fines that are part of a new city law will make things even harder for those struggling to find shelter. Also, Rhode Island PBS is shining a light on youth mental health. We'll talk with one of their contributors about the effect violence has on mental health. And Waterfire Providence has had financial struggles lately. They have a new interim director who says he plans to be a bridge to a brighter future. All that and more on this episode of The Weekly Catch. The city of Woonsocket is moving forward with a new ordinance that makes it illegal to camp out on public property and carries a fine of up to $250 for repeat violators. Critics say the change is going to harm unhoused people who will be burdened with legal troubles and fines they can't pay. To talk more about this, I'm joined by Bonnie Pikarski, a community activist and founder of the Milagros Project. It's a Woonsocket-based group that serves people experiencing poverty and homelessness. Bonnie, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why are you troubled by this new ordinance, and what troubles you most about it?
I'm troubled by the new ordinance just because we know how many people are experiencing homelessness right now in the city of Woonsocket that are completely unhoused. And as an outreach worker and an advocate for these folks, it's deeply troubling because it's going to exasperate an already difficult situation. Getting court fines, as we know, they're probably not going to get paid, and they will eventually result in a warrant and get these folks into the justice system. And so that's definitely going to impair them more than they already have with the struggles that they're going through.
If you could talk a little bit more about that, I wanted to know, practically speaking, you know, the impact this is going to have on people who are penalized for camping out.
So currently we have about 17 encampments in the city of Woonsocket, right? And so what does that look like? Are the, you know, we're preparing our citizens that live outside with the tools that they need, as well as the homeless bill of rights, which might and probably will be violated if they start doing sweeps, if they start bringing down these encampments. And so the worry is that more folks are going to end up clogging the court system. Our public safety and police departments are going to be overwhelmed trying to keep finding these folks or giving these folks ultimatums. And I think, and that this is the rhetoric that we see with the other side, is that they're complaining that taxpayers' resources are being used on the homeless, when in fact this would also exasperate taxpayers' resources by using public safety, our court system, our jail system. And I think that they're not understanding that.
As you already know, homelessness is a bigger challenge for Woonsocket now than it has been in past years. I wanted to get sense from you. What have you seen over the last few years, and how is this affecting the community?
The change that we've seen in homelessness, is specifically the face, is that we're starting to see more families. The Kids Count Fact Book actually just came out, the 2025 Fact Book, and about over 300 children were identified as homeless by the school. So that's quite an increase of young people that we've been seeing homeless. A lot more families because of rent increases. We have a median income of $49,000 in the city of Woonsocket, which is almost impossible to pay the rents that are now the average rent in the city. So we're looking at $1,800, $2,200. That's about 70% of your income would have to go towards rent in order to survive. So the increase that we're seeing is, you know, a lack of affordable housing, even though Woonsocket always boasts that it is exceeding the 10% cap. There just simply needs to be more because the city just has so much poverty.
Did I hear correct? 300 kids in Woonsocket alone?
Correct. And that was identified by the Woonsocket Education Department. So these are students. These are Woonsocket residents, because you have to have residency to be enrolled in school. And so this conversation that's often had, that we're somehow busing people in from other cities, simply isn't true. In conversations with the folks that live outside, a lot of us have deep relationships with them. We know that many of them are actually born and raised in the city of Woonsocket. They don't just appear here overnight and set a tent up.
Can we put our finger on any one thing and say this is the reason this is happening?
I mean, poverty is the bottom line. Again, you know, people don't have the resources that they need. they're not making enough money to survive the influxes of price and increases of prices that we're seeing. And, you know, it's just there. Once you're homeless, you kind of get stuck in this spiral of trying to get out. A lot of folks that we see are actually working. They just can't afford the rents, or they've had evictions. And then once you have an eviction, it's almost impossible to get another apartment. And another thing is that landlords are charging double. So the first and last they're charging, but now there's legislation going up for them to be able to charge twice that. So you're looking at, if you have like a $1,500 apartment, you're looking at coming up with about $5,000 to move in, which is nearly impossible for a lot of these folks that are experiencing homelessness.
City leaders have said that they can't have people camping on public property, and this is something that has to be addressed. Do you think they have a point?
Well, I think people should be housed. So yeah, they do have a point. You know, I respect the moves that our mayor has recently made. Mayor Beauchamp, it's a stark contrast of Mayor Baldelli that formerly we had in Bulldoze encampments. He's actually been working with activists, working with advocates to come up with ways and solutions to deal with the homeless crisis in the city. We have Open Doors moving in and opening a shelter in about a month from now. So I know that the goal is to kind of clean, quote unquote, clean these encampments up and get these people into shelter. But as we know, simply everyone is not going to want to go into the shelter. There's still going to be people living outside. And what are the consequences for those folks?
If you were the mayor, how would you do things differently?
You know, it's hard to say, but I definitely would allow builders to come in with affordable housing. We are blessed to have NeighborWorks River Valley, which is affordable housing. They build affordable housing in the city and throughout the state. And we have a lot of open properties that could definitely be renovated. So I would encourage more affordable housing for folks into the community. Again, I would expand the beds at Open Doors. Right now, it's limited to 50. It has the capacity in that building to hold 100. And I would definitely at least open it to at least 75 to kind of start with, engage, and make sure that people get the services that they need.
I believe city councilors have said that the fine would not mean that people would end up with criminal charges. Is that right?
That was said on Monday, but, you know, if somebody ends up with a fine, they would, and they don't pay it, you end up with a warrant for not paying the fine. So you would end up with criminal charges. So that is simply not true.
One of the other things the city council passed, of course, also was a resolution for a new homeless shelter. Is that a viable solution right now? And how do you want to see this completed that you think would be useful?
I mean, I think it's a temporary solution. However, Open Doors' model is more of a permanent supportive housing model, which I think is really important. Another big piece is that there'll be wraparound services within the same building. So you're looking at Thundermiss Health, Community Care Alliance, all tied into the one building space. So it's more of a community approach, which is really, really going to be important because a lot of these folks are coming in with behavioral health and mental health problems. And so being able to access them, being able to get them the supports that they need, being able to get them into permanent supportive housing, and making sure that they can stay there is going to be just really important and imperative right now.
Bonnie Piekarski, community activist and founder of the Milagros Project. I really appreciate the time, Bonnie. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
We reached out to the Woonsocket mayor and city council president for comment, but did not hear back. We'll be back with more on The Weekly Catch.
For Pediatric Mental Health Week, Rhode Island PBS and the Publix Radio are expanding statewide coverage through community storytelling. We're sharing stories about how local youth are facing mental health challenges with growing resilience and support, ultimately finding hope. To hear these stories, access resources, and share your personal experience, visit ripbs.org/findinghope. This project was made possible by the generous support of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Rhode Island.
This is the Publix Radio. I'm Luis Hernandez. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. Our political reporter Ian Donis joins me now to break down the week in Rhode Island politics. Ian, always a pleasure.
Good to be with you, Lewis.
Ian, advocates are pressing for an increase in taxes on upper-income Rhode Islanders this year. Is this likely to happen?
This issue has been debated for many years, and legislative leaders have had kind of a reflexive inclination against considering broad-based tax increases. But the budget outlook is more uncertain than ever due to what's happening in Washington, due to a worse fiscal climate in Rhode Island. So there is at least a possibility that this will get more consideration this year than in previous years.
Another bill being debated would impose a refundable 10-cent deposit on bottles and cans. How's the outlook for this?
That's unclear. It's being heavily debated on both sides. I remember being a college kid in Massachusetts when a bottle bill was introduced there. It was a nickel, a bottle, or a can, and that sent college kids scrounging around to collect these to defray their beer expenses. But the package industry lobby is opposed to this very sharply. They say this will add to the trouble and cost for consumers and retailers. Environmental activists say a bottle bill means a lot less stuff goes into landfills. So there will be another hearing on this in the House of Representatives on Tuesday, following one in the Senate last week.
And finally, Rhode Island Attorney General Peter Nerona this week unveiled another lawsuit against the Trump administration, this one involving the Federal Health and Human Services Department. What is the legal basis for this?
Nerona says that President Trump is usurping Congress's power of the purse, that the president is exceeding his authority by making dramatic cuts to the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, and that this was an agency that was created by Congress, and that only Congress has the power to really make these kind of sweeping changes being overseen by Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr.
Ian, it's always a pleasure. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you, Lewis.
For more politics news, you can listen to the latest episode of Political Roundtable or read Ian's TGIF column out every Friday at 4 p.m. This week, Rhode Island PBS has been shining a light on youth mental health in the region. It's part of a series of reports in May in recognition of mental health awareness. The newest episode of Generation Rising looks at the effect of violence on mental health, and it highlights the work of the Nonviolence Institute in Providence, helping young people process emotions and break cycles of community violence. I'm joined now by Anaritis Rodriguez, host of Generation Rising. Anaritis, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Luis. It is great to be here with you today.
Can you begin just by telling us what is the Nonviolence Institute and what kind of work do they do?
The Nonviolence Institute is located in Providence on Oxford Street, and they do a number of things. They do street outreach. They do case management. They do victim services. They also provide nonviolence training for corporations, schools, hospitals, basically any organization that seeks it. And they also do youth programs, and their teachings are anchored on Martin Luther King's principles of nonviolence.
Your episode on the Nonviolence Institute looks at the impact that violence has on people's mental health. Just briefly, how does violence affect our mental health?
We did speak with a child psychiatrist, Dr. Wyvern Oswad, and I mean, the impact of violence has long been studied and researched and shows that exposure to violence, either directly or indirectly, has a significant and lasting impact on people's mental health, leading to increased risk of depression, anxiety, PTSD, and other mental health challenges. And this is especially difficult for young people who rely on their caregivers for their safety and need that safe environment to be around and exposure to violence to be controlled to a certain degree, right?
It's clear in the segment that our mental health well-being can sometimes influence the way young people relate to one another and how they communicate to each other.
Definitely. We spoke to a child psychiatrist, and he specializes in working in urban environments. And he explained to us the impact of trauma, telling us that when a person experiences a stressful event, their cortisol levels, their stress hormones increase. And then when it's over, it goes back to baseline. But when folks are living with ongoing stressors, ongoing violence, their cortisol levels don't go back to baseline. They just keep going up and they stay stuck. That baseline changes, and that can have a wide-ranging impact on both your physical and your mental health.
In the show, you talk with teenagers about mental health and how it impacts them and their friends. I want to listen to a short clip and then get your reaction.
Do you talk about your mental health amongst you and your friends?
Kids these days feel afraid to show their emotions or say anything that's they think is out of line to their friends. They feel like they can't come to their friends about other stuff because their friends will either joke around with them or just feel like they're not taking it serious, and their friends will never take it serious. And that's a problem nowadays.
They feel like they're going to be ridiculed.
Yeah.
Or othered by expressing themselves?
Especially as a boy, though. Yeah.
Just boys. As a male?
Yeah, as a male, showing your emotions already enough. And then just showing your emotions to your friends as a male, too. It's not
they set that standard for males for us to be tough and strong and not, like, to just deal with it on our own. But some people really can't, and that's why people end up the way they do.
What did you think when you heard these boys share that?
I was so impressed by them. That was Jerry Niccolo and Bentley Taveras. And Bentley is actually the grandson of Lisa Pina Warren, who's the executive director of the Nonviolence Institute. And she brought him into this program during their spring break this past April. And I was just so impressed by them being so genuine and really telling me what was going on. I felt like, you know, or I thought that they were going to be jaded teenagers, and they were far from that. They were so in tune with their feelings and their emotions. And we had arrived there on day 4 of the program, so I wondered if that had any impact in how they were able to express themselves. But I just thought that, you know, at 14, 15 years old, to have these boys have this type of awareness of the pressures of the world on especially boys and men to act tough and to be tough and not show emotion was really fascinating to me. And it ties back to speaking with Dr. Oswad when he says that when young people don't have the tools or the skills to be able to regulate or manage their emotions, they find their own ways to do it. And that can mean acting tough or isolating. And in some cases, the impact of trauma on teenagers can take the form of outburst. So I just found them to be so courageous for telling their story and being so honest with me, someone that they literally had just met.
Tell me about one of the programs at the Nonviolence Institute that helps young people processing emotions.
Yeah. So the SEEDS program is their program for young people. I think you could be as young as 14 or 15 years old. It is a nonviolence-focused job training program designed for in-risk youth. And they pay teenagers a stipend of $200 to participate for the week. And some of the teenagers we spoke with, they were really honest. And they were like, honestly, when I first got here, I really just wanted the $200. And that's why I came. But after being here and meeting everyone, they felt so safe. And they learned some incredible skills that are going to last a lifetime for them. So this class, it teaches them about the intersection of nonviolence and social justice, how to solve conflicts without using violence, the critical thinking about the practice of nonviolence in today's world, how do you celebrate as a community in a healthy way. So they brainstorm and they talk about all different ways to understand how mental health and wellness is connected to the practice of nonviolence. It's also really interesting to me that they teach mindfulness, which is just a practice and that can take many forms, but sometimes folks use singing bowls, they use sound healing, or they use breathing methods as a practice to stay in the present, relax the body, calm your nervous system, while also being aware of your feelings without judgment. And they do that before the beginning of each class. And that just enhances their emotional regulation, and the kids respond to it. And it is fascinating to see, as Lisa told me, their transformation from when they walk in and they only want the $200 to when they walk out and they envision themselves as peacemakers.
Ana Rittes Rodriguez is host of Generation Rising. Ana Rittes, thanks so much for sharing. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Luis, for having me.
Generation Rising airs Friday night at 7:30 and Sunday morning at 10:30. You can also find Ana Rittes' story on YouTube. The special series on youth mental health is underwritten through a grant by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Rhode Island. We'll be back with more from The Weekly Catch in just a moment.
How has the closure of the Washington Bridge impacted your life? We want to hear from you and share your stories as part of Breaking Point, a community-centered reporting project from Rhode Island PBS and the Publix Radio. What we hear from you will help shape our reporting. Share your Washington Bridge story and hear from others in our community at thepublixradio.org/breakingpoint. That's thepublixradio.org/breakingpoint.
This is The Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez, and it's time for Artscape. As we move closer to the summer, we edge closer to the first water fire lighting ceremony of the year. It'll take place at the end of the month. Water Fire Providence is going through some changes. This year, they named Mark Allen as the interim executive director. What changes will be coming to Water Fire? Well, joining me now is Mark Allen to talk about that. Mark, welcome.
Glad to be here.
What I'd like to know is, what is your assessment after 5 months now of the challenges this nonprofit is facing, and what are a couple of the big things that you want to tackle immediately or that you've been tackling?
There are two or three challenges. One is financial. Money has been very tight. There were some substantial losses in 2023 that put it in an extremely tight position. So for any nonprofit, that's a critical matter. But also, it's fairly modest size, but what it does is extremely complex. There are many organizations of this size that get steady funding from one or two sources. They deliver a service, you know, think like a residential program for people or something like that. This is very complex. Its funding sources are multiple, none of which are fully reliable year to year. And what it does is create a public event on a waterway with fire using wooden boats and metal braziers in a way that's extremely challenging physically, and does it using perhaps 1,200 volunteers in the course of a year. So the complexity of it is massive. And the tendency of an organization of this size is to be very informal in the way it operates and work with a lot of heart and not as much organization. And Water Fire needs to be sophisticated and, if you will, punch above its weight organizationally to really effectively deliver this going forward.
You know, we spoke with Barnaby Evans, the executive artistic director, last year. We asked him about the financial situation. And I'm wondering, you know, how do you see it? Because you talked about that. That was the first thing you mentioned. That was the big challenge. But, you know, he's optimistic, but he also says there's a realism we got to deal with. I'm wondering, again, after 5 months, what do you see?
Well, I see this was built around corporate support initially, I think. Sponsorships, large corporations, and that was the heart of it way back. And you're going back almost 30 years, right? And that is still present, but it's much diminished because of the changes in Providence and its region itself. And the corporations that were here, some have moved away, many have been acquired, and that kind of local corporate support, which I've worked with in other settings, not for Water Fire as a product, is very powerful when it exists. And as it starts to break up, it no longer has that strength. And we've been riding that for a long time. It still exists, but it's in decline. And I think there's a tendency for an organization, when things have worked, to sort of continue down that path. So we actually are redoubling our efforts with corporations. But that clearly isn't the core future for us. We're looking at all the methods of support and becoming more sophisticated. And then a particular area that surprisingly we haven't done much with at all is support from large donors, from wealthy individuals. either as gifts or as bequests. You'd expect that we'd be doing that, and that hasn't been part of the repertoire. So we are starting that up quite substantially. It takes time, obviously, to develop that. But that'll be a new area that we add to what we need.
You know, a lot of groups obviously are feeling the pinch as politics have gotten involved, and we're seeing cuts to arts across the board. And I'm wondering how is that affecting you?
Well, a couple things. The most immediate is at the national level, and we get no money nationally through the arts. So that has no direct effect. And even the changes, the funding we get at the state level doesn't go through the normal sort of formal arts pathways. So we're less vulnerable. Everyone is vulnerable because everyone's going to be hit. The states are all going to be hit through Medicaid and that kind of thing. But in a direct sense, we're sitting in a relatively good place. The other thing is we're not just an arts creation. The art is front and center. The art is where it started with Barnaby, but we have tremendous positive economic impact. We're very profitable for the state. The comparison between what we generate in tax revenues and what they give us, they make out very well. So that kind of transaction has a different flavor than support just as a gift for the arts.
Mark Allen is the interim executive director at Water Fire Providence. Mark, thanks so much. I really appreciate the time.
It's been a pleasure, really.
Artscape producer James Baumgartner joins me to share a few things on what to do this week. James, what's going on?
Well, while the first full lighting for Waterfire is on May 31st, they are having a Starts at Sunset event on Thursday, May 15th. It's an immersive event with musicians and artists and lighting the braziers at the Van Leesten Pedestrian Bridge in Providence. And that event is from 7 to 10 with sunset at 7:59. And next week is Bike to Work Week with a few special events for bike commuters. On Friday, RIPTA will be at the Providence Pedestrian Bridge, and they'll also be at Newport City Hall. And in both locations, they'll have treats and goodies for people who are using their bikes to get to work. There's more information at ripta.com/biketowork. And of course, Sunday is Mother's Day. There are a few special brunch events at places like Newport Vineyards and the Leyden Farm Vineyard. But if your mom is a fan of classical music, there's Music at the Farm with bassist Nina Bernat and pianist Anthony Ratanov playing works by Bloch, Copland, Bach, and more. It's an indoor event at Grace Note Farm in Pasco. The concert is at 2 p.m., but if the weather is nice, guests are welcome to bring a picnic lunch and enjoy the farm starting at 1.
Lots of great stuff. Thank you, James.
Thanks, Lewis.
That's it for our show. The Weekly Catch is a production of the Public Radio. Our producer is James Baumgartner. Our editor this week is Alex Nunes. Our chief content officer, Sally Isley. And our president and CEO is Pam Johnston. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thanks for listening.